May it please the court. My name is Stephanie Adraktis, and I represent the petitioner David Falcone. Mr. Falcone was convicted of first-degree murder in a trial where his counsel was prejudicially ineffective in three ways. The first error was his failure to move prior to trial to suppress Mr. Falcone's custodial statements. Secondly, he failed to introduce at the mid-trial suppression hearing tape recordings that would have impeached the police officer testimony that they had stopped questioning Mr. Falcone after he asked for a lawyer and that they'd honored his invocation of his right to counsel. The tapes would have also impeached the officer testimony about the substance of Mr. Falcone's statements that he had said that he was present at the scene of the crime and that his brother had pulled the trigger, because his statements on the recordings included a statement, "I was framed," and also, "He's not my brother." And the final error was the attorney's failure to impeach the police officer's false testimony that Falcone had not disclosed his alibi witness and another witness until the day before trial. In fact, trial counsel had in his own file the police chronological record of its investigation, which included notes that the alibi witness had been disclosed in November 2004, about a year before the October 2005 trial. These combined errors ensured a conviction at this trial because they unfairly discredited Mr. Falcone's alibi. The prosecutor took advantage.
Statements to the police. They didn't introduce the first two statements. They introduced the statement by Ramos at the booking and the third trial, neither of which were transcribed. So it's very hard to put together whatever complaints you have about, you know, which some of which seem to me perhaps have some merit about the first two interrogations or non-interrogations. Because they didn't introduce them. So I had a very hard time understanding how it all hooked together.
Yes, Your Honor, it was confusing. Even during the hearing, there had to be some correction by the police about exactly the sequence of events during the process. But the case law emphasizes Edwards and Miranda itself that the interrogation should be viewed as a totality, and this one was a continuous process. First, Mr. Falcone was brought into the interrogation room. He was advised of his rights. He asked for a lawyer. Then the police continued to interrogate him. They urged him to call them at the jail. They misled him about whether or not he could have a lawyer during the interrogation and told him he couldn't have one until after he was arraigned. You know, they made other statements and continued and also interrogated him about his alleged gang ties. So they violated his rights at the very beginning of the interrogation process. And the case law in this this court's decision in Collazo versus Estelle discusses this, that initial violation of Mr. Falcone's rights is important because it must be corrected before any of the subsequent statements can be admitted. The statements that were allegedly volunteered and spontaneous during the booking process were made almost immediately after the violation of his right to counsel. And so this was a continuous process where those purportedly spontaneous statements were actually the product of the illegality that occurred when the police, you know, lied to him about when he could get a lawyer and also did not honor his invocation of his right to counsel. The process was this.
Were these three separate interviews that occurred at different times?
They were, from what we can tell from the record, this all happened in one short sequence of time. The police tried to interrogate him. He asked a couple times for a lawyer. They didn't honor his invocation. They then took him purportedly downstairs for booking. Mr. Falcone told the booking officer, I'm really stressed out, I'm really nervous, what do I do? The booking officer said, did you talk to the detectives? Now, that clearly, by the booking officer, is not a booking question. It's an invitation for Mr. Falcone to go back and talk to the detectives. And what that demonstrated was that this was a continuous process that the police officers were, including the booking officers, acting as a team to extract these statements from Mr. Falcone. This wasn't a separate incident at the booking area where Mr. Falcone just spontaneously and on his own made the statement. He made it in response to the questioning by Officer Ramos.
I have a question. What's your best case that you're depending upon to show that this was a continuous interrogation that was illegal from the start, including the booking?
Yes, Your Honor. This court's en banc decision in Collazo versus Estelle provides an analytical framework for a situation like this where a person is interrogated, their rights are violated, and then they purportedly made a voluntary statement later. And the framework requires the court to look at whether the process that resulted in the statements, was it a continuous process or was there a break in the stream of events? And here there was no break. It was essentially four police officers. There were two detectives, two booking officers, and in fact, another officer, Baker, who joined in on this, were all working as a team during this entire interrogation process. They tried to interrogate him. They took him downstairs. They took him back to the detectives. Then they took him back to booking, and then they took him back to the detectives again. There was no break in this process at all. So the Collazo opinion supports our argument that this was a continuous interrogation process. There was also no change in the people involved. The detective who was the lead, Detective Myers, was the person who was involved in all of the interrogations that all took place in a continuous sequence. And there was nothing to break the effect of the original illegality. The police officers and the detectives didn't even claim that they re-advised Mr. Falcone of his Miranda rights and elicited a waiver at any time during any of the interrogations after the first violation of his Miranda rights.
But Edwards doesn't require that if the later interrogations were voluntary. So your argument depends on the connection between the interrogations, right? If it was in fact a separate voluntary interrogation, then you wouldn't need a separate Miranda advisement. Is that right?
Under Oregon versus Bradshaw, directly addresses that issue. Under Edwards, the court held that a person, once they've invoked, can make a voluntary statement later. But the Bradshaw opinion emphasizes that the later process is a two-step process. In other words, you don't just say, well, he volunteered to talk to us after he asked for a lawyer. The police are required to show that after the suspect reinitiates the conversation, that they advise the suspect of his or her Miranda rights and that they elicited a waiver. And those opinions emphasize that there are special safeguards in a situation like this where a person has already invoked their right to counsel. This isn't like a case where the person has not indicated any reluctance to talk to the police or has not indicated.
If I may, your briefs were sadly deficient in all this, and it was very difficult to understand from the briefs what you were arguing about the connection, which is so why we're having to struggle with it now. So this was all kind of not there in the original briefs, and I sort of don't know what to make of it now.
Well, Your Honor, because the trial court never litigated this issue, and our argument is that trial counsel was ineffective for failing to introduce the evidence at the hearing that would have allowed the trial court to even make a decision on this question. The trial court never addressed it. The Court of Appeal didn't address it, and the district court didn't address it. So essentially,
the state trial court did address it, right?
The state trial court.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Go
The state trial court found that the police had honored Mr. Falcone's initial invocation of his right to counsel, and its entire opinion, that of the trial court and the court of appeal, rested on that basis. They found that there wasn't any violation of his invocation of his right to counsel, and that's how the issue was presented below. It was not litigated whether or not the subsequent statements to Officer Ramos were admissible as spontaneous, because the court found that there was no Miranda error to begin with. And that's why these tape recordings were so crucial to Mr. Falcone's suppression hearing, because if trial counsel had introduced those tape recordings, the trial court would have been forced to acknowledge that the police did not, in fact, honor his right to counsel. They didn't stop questioning him. They, in fact,
question him about the gang question. Was that basically it?
The gang question, and in addition, the fact that they continued to speak with him. The transcript shows that instead of saying, okay, you want an attorney, we can't speak to you anymore, they just switched to other subjects and began talking to him about
they were booking questions, but they weren't actually booking him at that.
Exactly, Your Honor. It comes across as a pretextual, a pretext to keep talking to him, even though he's asked for a lawyer, because clearly these are the detectives and it's not their job to book him, but they start asking him about his medical issues. They ask him to take things out of his shoe, and then they start moving into more substantive questions about, are you a gang member? Things like that. They're still questioning him and they're not honoring his invocation of his right to counsel. And that's why the record.
Talk about the alibi
question. Yes, Your Honor. The counsel's failure to impeach the detective's testimony that he was never told about Mr. Falcone's alibi was also devastating to his defense. The prosecutor, in his closing argument, throughout both his initial closing argument and his rebuttal argument, said things like the alibi witness never once came forward. She never told us, said anything about having been with Mr. Falcone on the day of the charged incident until the day before trial. And he returned to this theme again and again, saying that, well, if you believed this alibi, you should acquit him, but you shouldn't believe it because she's a liar. She just sat there during this entire year that this case was pending and never told anybody that she was with Mr. Falcone during the shooting. And that was absolutely false. And defense counsel could have presented evidence from the detective's own file that the defense attorney's paralegal, who could have also testified, had personally told the detectives about the alibi witness and that they had that information a year before trial.
I mean, apparently the strongest testimony would have been from the paralegal, but the I'm not sure which, concluded that he wouldn't have testified. Does that make sense?
Your Honor, it really didn't make sense, because at the time of trial, the paralegal was working for defense counsel. If he had been reluctant to give a declaration after trial, there was an obvious conflict between his interests and that of his employer, because there would have been the allegation of ineffective assistance of counsel, and that wouldn't have been a consideration at the time of trial. So there was no reason to not call him. And in fact, the district attorney in his closing argument made much of the fact that defense counsel didn't call his own staff to tell the jury that any one of them had disclosed the alibi to the police. And so the sum total of these errors, the false impeachment of the alibi witness, the failure to make a motion to exclude the statements prior to trial, and the failure to competently litigate the admissibility of the statements was prejudicial, and for the reasons explained in the brief, the de novo standard of review should apply because of the Court of Appeals' unreasonable determinations of fact.
I have a question. I wanted to know how much of these statements that were made that you claim were illegally taken were introduced in the trial in chief.
Your Honor, there were two statements that were introduced in rebuttal. None of the statements were introduced in the prosecutor's case in chief. He waited till the rebuttal, and then he introduced testimony of Officer Ramos and testimony of Detective Myers. Both of... Yes, Your Honor. Was there another question?
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Is there, ultimately, can you show prejudice here? Because it seems like the evidence was pretty strong here. You had two of the people who were at the murder scene identify him, and then the police, he led the police to the murder weapon, the gun in his house, in the closet. Isn't that pretty overwhelming evidence? Can even if you talk about the potential evidence that was excluded or not included, how do you show prejudice here?
Your Honor, the prosecutor himself told the jury, if you believe this alibi, you've got to acquit Mr. Falcone. And he was essentially conceding that the evidence of identification was equivocal. The witness who Mr. Carroll, who testified at the preliminary hearing, didn't testify at trial. And the only identification that he had made was in a pretrial photo lineup. And then the witness who did testify at trial had been equivocal in her statements throughout the investigation. At one point, she identified Mr. Falcone's brother and thought it was the same person that she had identified earlier as the shooter. And so she wasn't quite 100% clear in her identification. And the record also shows that she ran away from the incident when it first started to turn violent. She went for help and tried to call someone. So she wasn't present during the entire incident and during the actual shooting. So, and as to the gun, the evidence shows that when the police came to Mr. Falcone's house, he was the one that showed them where it was. He told them it's in the closet. And his statement later apparently was that a person who lived at the house testified that another individual named Joker had brought a package to the house with the gun in it and that she had hidden it. So there was not
She'd hidden it in the closet, that she'd hidden it under the porch. So yes, I didn't understand the whole story. How that hooks up with the gun in the closet.
Yes, Your Honor, there wasn't an explanation for how the gun was moved from under the porch to the closet. And there was an indication in the record, several comments by different people, that the witness who gave that testimony was had a disability, some sort of mental disability. It was never expanded upon beyond that, but apparently she was somewhat developmentally delayed, so it wasn't entirely clear what had happened with her. But the evidence was not conclusive in the identification of Mr. Falcone. And also, there was an alibi witness in addition to Mr. Falcone's girlfriend. There was an alibi witness who was not related to him, was not biased in his favor, who testified that Mr. Falcone was at the girlfriend's house around the time of the charged incident. So his alibi was equally strong as the evidence against him, and the prosecutor essentially admitted that in his closing argument. If you believe the alibi, you've got to find him not guilty.
Okay, thank you very much. You're over your time. We'll give you a minute in rebuttal. Mr. Dominguez.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, Carlos Dominguez on behalf of the Attorney General. Before I begin, I just want to make clear, the situation that counsel was in. He was faced with a difficult case, leaving him few options. The prosecution established petitioner's role in the shooting with two eyewitness identifications. The murder weapon, like the court indicated, was found in petitioner's closet. And when the police approached him, petitioner fled. Once in custody, petitioner admitted to the police that he was present at the scene of the shooting, but that he wasn't the shooter. Faced with this evidence, counsel presented an alibi defense supported by several witnesses as an alternative theory. Now, I'd like to first focus on the Miranda claim, because that's, I think, it relates to the alibi claim. But I want to make clear the two statements that were admitted in this case were properly admitted. One, as spontaneous statements made to the booking officer, and the second statement to Detective Myers was properly admitted once he reinitiated the interview process with the detective. As far as the spontaneous statement, that statement was made.
It wasn't that spontaneous. There was a response to the question, and did you talk to the police, right?
Well, it he was the booking process was going to be begin with Officer Ramos, and it was petitioner who initiated the conversation. He was nervous. He asked the Officer Ramos, you know, what should I do? And Officer Ramos asked him, have you talked to the detectives? And the court has to look at that question and see if it's that was designed to elicit an incriminating statement. That question in itself was neutral in nature. It didn't ask petitioner anything about the crime. Petitioner was the one who initiated the conversation, and Officer Ramos didn't ask any follow-up questions or, you know, ask any details about petitioner's statement. That statement was properly admitted as spontaneous, and that's why it came in.
And that statement, according to Ramos, Officer Ramos, was, I was there, but it was my brother who did it. Was that the story then?
What's that, Your Honor? I'm sorry.
What was the statement exactly?
It was the same statement that he made later. It wasn't, you know, with as much detail, but it was, I was there, but it wasn't, you know, it was my brother who did the shooting. Yes. And the second statement, both of these statements were introduced at trial. And the second statement to Detective Myers was made, after he again reinitiated the interviewing process. Like the court indicated, there was no obligation again to re-advise petitioner of the Miranda waivers. He had just been advised earlier of his Miranda rights.
That's the question, and it hasn't really been briefed. I mean, under what, or put another way, I understand your opponent's argument to be that that he had already invoked his right to attorney. It was part of the same, at least the third interview was part of the same set of interrogations, whether he asked to come or not, and that they shouldn't have been at least re-Mirandized him for.
And I don't think
these questions on the briefs. I agree with you, but that's sure. That's my understanding.
That's the problem. I don't think it was raised in the opening brief, and I tried to raise why the statements that were admitted, why they were properly admitted. I think the transcripts support the finding that these were all separate interviews. Of course, the booking interview was not an interview, that was booking. There is no per se, you know.
But if you actually look objectively at the first two transcripts, they did keep talking to him about, I mean, there were supposedly booking questions. They weren't booking him, so why were they talking to him? And moreover, some of them weren't booking questions, like, were you in a gang? It seems to me that they did keep talking to him when they shouldn't have. That's number one. And number two is that there were definite inaccuracies as to what was found to have happened, because most obviously to me, they say that they kept insisting at the trial that he, at the suppression hearing, that he had whispered this thing about his brother after the first interrogation, but the second one itself demonstrates that that wasn't true. It was before the second one, if he said it at all, and then he said it wasn't my brother.
Let me deal with the first one, and then we can talk about, you know, that it was my brother. I think the record, you know, if we read the first transcript, the record reflects that after he invoked his right to counsel and the detective said, fair enough, that'll be it. You know, I got to fill out some paperwork. They stopped asking him questions. It was petitioner who was asking questions. You know, what am I charged with? Do they, you know, did he die? You know, those kind of questions. As far as the booking questions themselves, they were all booking questions except for that gang membership.
They weren't booking him. Why were they asking him?
I can't speak to the you know, police procedures at, you know, at the time or what happened. But the gang membership question, if you look at the case that petitioner cites, and this is California Supreme Court law, this is state court law. If you keep reading after that cite, it says, and I want to quote, to be clear, it is permissible to ask arrestees about gang affiliation during the booking process. Jail officials have an important institutional interest to minimize potential violence. We simply hold that, you know, and I'm going to paraphrase, the answers are not admissible in the prosecution's case in chief. And this wasn't a gang case. It wasn't charged as a gang case. They properly asked him the questions, and any answers as far as, you know, whether he was in a gang or not were not admitted at trial. So any of those questions, I think, are not relevant to the issue. I think the transcript does show that it was petitioner the one initiating the conversation. He was the one asking the questions, and the detectives were answering those questions. As far as the second issue, and if you can clarify, Your Honor, I think you're talking about the "it was my brother" statement. Is that
right? And the person who testified at trial insisted that it was right after the first interrogation, but in fact, the second one is detective says, "Now you whispered it was your family. You were lying when you told me right now before you came in the room that it was your brother. You were lying." So.
If you read the suppression testimony by Detective Myers, and the prosecutor clarifies this point to the court, is Detective Myers testified that petitioner whispered, you know, "it was my brother." The prosecutor makes the point that you know it's very hard to hear, and I think the Court of Appeal and the District Court both mentioned this. It was very hard to hear, so chances are you're not going to get it in a transcript, and we don't see it. But we know that need, because in that second transcript, the detective asks petitioner, "Now you whispered it was your family, you know."
Just now. And then he says, "He's not my brother. He's not your brother." So.
And I think then the court has to ask whether it was the statement "it was my brother" made at the end of the first interview or at this reinitiation or at the start of this one, if that is going to materially impeach the testimony of the detective.
Right. And so what about the alibi? I mean, I can tell you what troubled me was consistent. I mean, it was over and over and over again in the closing arguments, both of them.
No connection to Mr. Falcone other than the fact that he lived in the same building as Mr. Falcone's girlfriend. And in fact, if anything, the witness was biased against Mr. Falcone because, as he testified, he was frequently annoyed by Mr. Falcone's presence at the building, that he felt like he would dispose of trash in the common area. And so that was
the problem. Was it was really hard to figure out how he could have been there about a particular day and known at a certain time and known that they were there.
And he testified that he was waiting that day for a disability check, and that he also knew which day it was because he had, and also what time it was because he kept to a very strict routine of when he went to the restroom in relation to when he took his medications. So he did explain why he was in particular aware of that date. And also keeping in mind that the alibi witness did come forward quite early in this case. We know from the dates in the police notes that it was November 4th when it was disclosed to them. So they must have identified this witness much earlier, and it would have been much easier for him to reconstruct what he did that day so early in time. I agree. If you're going to ask someone a year later what they were doing, you know, on September 17th, they couldn't accurately relate that. But in this case, the investigation was done early and the witnesses were identified early. I believe I'm out of time. So
I'm curious. One question. In the chronological record notes, 11-4, spoke with paralegal for Larry Young, attorney for Falcon, advised of possible alibi. Then it's a C notes, but we don't have any notes. Right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't hear the last.
C notes, after that notation says C notes.
Yes, Your Honor, we don't, I don't have it in my record, those referenced notes. So it looks like there were separate notes, but those were not included in the record. I know that, I don't know if the court is familiar with this part of the litigation of this case, but there was an extensive litigation by Mr. Falcone against the lawyer who was initially retained to file his federal habeas petition and who had the entire file. And it was never, Mr. Falcone was never able to obtain it from him. And so we don't have the entire record.
Okay. Your time is up. Thank you very much. The case of Falcone versus McDowell was submitted, and we'll go to the last case, which is Claudia Sarahi Rueda Vidal versus DHS.